Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're plunging into a topic that feels like it's straight out of science fiction, yet it's fundamentally reshaping industries, agriculture, and even how we think about privacy in our skies.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about drones, those incredible flying machines. Their revolutionary impact is just undeniable, you know, from delivering packages to surveying vast lands.
Absolutely.
And that widespread adoption, well, it necessitates clear, robust rules. The speed at which this sector is changing, particularly from a regulatory standpoint, is truly remarkable.
It is indeed. And that phenomenal pace of change brings us right to the core of today's deep dive. A comprehensive exploration into the rapidly evolving legal landscape of drone operations, specifically in India.
Right.
It's a truly fascinating case study because it presents a unique challenge and opportunity. You know, not so long ago, drone technology in India was heavily restricted, almost stifled by regulations.
Yeah, I remember that.
But now it's being actively facilitated by a new, profoundly liberalized regulatory framework. It's quite a dramatic pivot.
That's what's so compelling about this. Our mission today is to unpack that transformation. We're going to delve into the key legislation that underpins this change, the crucial amendments that keep refining the rules, the essential compliance steps you need to know as an operator or business,
mm-hmm.
and even the judicial oversight that shapes India's very ambitious goal of becoming a global drone hub by 2030.
Exactly. So if you're an aspiring drone pilot, maybe a business looking to leverage this technology, an investor eyeing this burgeoning sector, or maybe just someone keen to understand how a nation balances innovation with safety and security within a legal framework. Well, this deep dive is for you.
Yeah.
We've designed it to give you a clear, structured understanding of what you need to know to navigate drone law in India, essentially turning complex legal documents into actionable, accessible insights.
Okay, let's unpack this transformation then, because the journey has been quite something. For a long time, India's drone regulations were, to put it mildly, a bit of a quagmire, right?
Oh, yeah.
Especially for anyone trying to actually do something with a drone.
Quagmire is, I think, an apt description. Before 2021, the landscape was highly restrictive and incredibly cumbersome. We're talking specifically about the Unmanned Aircraft System, or UAS, rules of March 2021. They were an attempt to regulate, sure, but they quickly became a bottleneck that really strangled potential growth.
What were the main criticisms? Why did they stifle growth so much?
Mm-hmm.
Because usually, you know, some regulation is better than none, isn't it?
Well, in this case, the specific nature of the regulation was the problem. Industry stakeholders were very vocal about it. The primary issues were excessive administrative bottlenecks and extremely lengthy approval timelines.
Mm.
Just imagine trying to innovate or scale a business when every single step from getting permission to manufacture to getting approval for a flight was bogged down in bureaucracy and could take months, literally months, to clear.
Wow.
It was a framework that perhaps inadvertently stifled the very industry it was meant to govern, making compliance just a Herculean task for many.
So recognizing these significant impediments, the government then executed a pretty dramatic policy pivot. This led to the introduction of the drone rules, 2021, notified on August 25th of that year.
Mm-hmm.
How fundamentally different were these new rules, truly? And what did that mean for, say, a startup trying to get off the ground?
Oh, they were a complete philosophical overhaul, frankly revolutionary compared to what came before. The restrictive UAS rules were entirely repealed, just gone.
Right.
The new drone rules, 2021, were founded on these core tenets of trust, self-certification, and non-intrusive monitoring. This was a very conscious move from rigid top-down control to a regime that actually aims to facilitate growth.
Okay.
So for a startup, this means instead of waiting for endless approvals, they can largely operate on a basis of trust, self-declaring compliance where possible. The government is essentially saying, look, we trust you to follow the rules and we'll monitor rather than control every minute detail.
That's a big shift.
It's a bold departure from traditional regulatory approaches, certainly, and it definitely lowers the initial barrier for a new entrance into the market.
And this shift isn't just about making things easier operationally. It's tied to a much larger strategic goal, isn't it? It sounds like India is making a pretty big bet here.
It's an enormous bet, yeah. And it's directly linked to India's ambition to become a global drone hub by 2030. To achieve that kind of goal, they knew they couldn't operate under the old restrictive framework. It just wouldn't work.
Makes sense.
They needed to create an environment where innovation could flourish, where businesses could scale rapidly, and where drone technology could be widely adopted across various sectors without being bogged down by the very system designed to oversee it. So this policy pivot is really the foundational step towards that national vision.
And we're not just talking about abstract philosophical shifts here. There were quantifiable, concrete examples of this simplification. The bureaucracy was significantly cut down, you mentioned.
Precisely. The reduction in red tape is, well, staggering when you look at the numbers. Consider this. The number of required forms for compliance was slashed from an astounding 25 down to just 5.
25 down to 5, wow.
Yeah, and the types of fees you had to pay, they were consolidated from 72 different types down to a mere 4.
72 fees. Good grief.
Exactly. Think about the administrative burden that eliminated for businesses that alone tells you how much friction they remove from the system. It translates directly into saved time and money for operators.
That's incredible. From 72 fee types down to 4. And it wasn't just about forms and fees, right? It was also about abolishing entire layers of approval that were previously mandatory.
Yes, absolutely. Numerous complex approvals that previously acted as really high barriers to entry were simply done away with.
Like what, for example?
Well, things like unique authorization numbers for each individual drone, separate certificates of manufacturing that could take ages to procure, tedious import clearances for every single unit, all of these were abolished. This significantly lowers the barrier for manufacturers, operators, and service providers to enter and hopefully thrive in the market. It makes it much more attractive for domestic and potentially international investment, too.
And central to this entire modernized framework, the sort of glue holding it all together, is the Digital Sky platform. This seems to be the single non-negotiable hub for everything drone-related in India from a legal and compliance standpoint.
It is indeed. It's basically the central nervous system for drone operations in India now. Digital Sky is designed as a user-friendly, single-window online system managed by the Directorate General of Civil Aviation, or DGCA.
Right.
Its purpose is to be the primary, and in many cases, the only interface between the regulator and the entire drone ecosystem in India.
So what kind of critical interactions and legal compliance steps are managed through this portal? What do you actually do on Digital Sky?
Pretty much everything, actually, from the initial registration of your drone to securing its type certification, from obtaining your remote pilot certificate to seeking real-time flight permissions. It all happens digitally through Digital Sky.
Right.
This digital-first approach isn't just about convenience, though. It's a cornerstone of the new regulatory framework, specifically designed to ensure transparency, boost efficiency, and genuinely ease compliance for all stakeholders. It's a massive leap forward from the paper-based, slow processes that characterized the previous era. For operators, knowing Digital Sky is knowing the gateway to legal operation.
Okay, that brings us to the actual legal bedrock. Well, the Digital Sky platform is the operational hub for compliance. The foundational document is still the Drone Rules 2021. Let's really unpack what these rules entail and how they've been refined by subsequent amendments, because as you said, even the main rules aren't static.
The Drone Rules 2021, notified on August 25th, 2021, are absolutely the core legal document. They swiftly replace those short-lived, highly restrictive UAS rules of March 2021 we discussed earlier.
Right, the ones that caused all the problems.
Exactly. And that immediate replacement demonstrated a crucial recognition by the government of the need for a more pragmatic and industry-friendly approach. They realized quickly it wasn't working.
And who do these rules apply to? Is it just commercial operators, or does it cast a wider legal net?
The scope is incredibly comprehensive, touching almost everyone. They apply to any person who owns, possesses, leases, operates, transfers, or even just maintains a drone in India.
Okay, so pretty broad.
Very broad. Furthermore, they apply to all unmanned aircraft systems being used within or over Indian territory, regardless of their origin, their specific use case, or whether they are for commercial or recreational purposes. This broad applicability ensures a consistent regulatory environment and leaves very little room for ambiguity in terms of who is bound by these laws.
So what were the foundational mandates introduced by these rules? What were the absolute must-dos for anyone entering this space from a legal compliance perspective?
There are several key requirements established right from day one that form the basis of legal drone operation in India now. First, there's the compulsory registration of drones to obtain a unique identification number, or UIN.
The digital license plate.
Exactly, your drone's digital license plate, critical for traceability. Second, manufacturers are now required to secure a type certificate, or TC, for their drone models, ensuring fundamental design and safety standards are met before they can be sold or operated.
Right.
Third, The rules mandated the creation of an interactive airspace map, which we'll definitely delve into later, to clearly segregate the sky into distinct operational zones.
Okay.
And significantly, the rules increased the weight coverage for drones from the previous 300 kilograms up to 500 kilograms. This expansion brought much heavier payload logistics drones and even the potential for future drone taxis under their purview, showcasing a future-looking regulatory vision that anticipates growth and capability.
Now, despite being a major improvement, the drone rules 2021 weren't static, as you mentioned. They've already seen refinements. The first major one was the drone amendment rules 2022, notified in February of that year. What did that amendment primarily address, and why was it important for streamlining legal processes?
Yeah, this first amendment focused on two critical areas to further streamline the process and make it more efficient. The first, and perhaps most significant, was pilot certification.
Okay. What changed there?
It effectively abolished the previous drone pilot license, which was issued directly by the DGCA and, you know, often involved long waiting times. Instead, it introduced the Remote Pilot Certificate, or RPC, which is now issued directly by DGCA-authorized Remote Pilot Training Organizations, or RPTOs.
Ah, so decentralizing it.
Precisely. This decentralization significantly expedites the pilot certification process, making it much more accessible and reducing the bottleneck at the regulator's end. Get trained, get certified by the training organization much faster.
That makes a lot of sense. Shifting the issuance power to the RPTOs made things faster. What was the second key change in that 2022 amendment?
The second change was more of a practical extension for owners of existing drones specifically, those manufactured in or imported into India on or before November 30, 2021.
Right, the ones already out there.
Exactly. They were given an extended deadline, pushing it to March 31st, 2022, to register their aircraft on the Digital Sky platform and obtain their UIN. This provided a crucial grace period for legacy drone owners to comply with the new registration mandates, acknowledging the reality that many drones were already in use before the rules were fully implemented.
That's a good example of the government listening and responding to ground realities, giving people time to catch up. And then we have the Drone Amendment Rules 2023, which were notified just last September. What specific barrier did this amendment tackle? This sounds like it directly impacted a very specific demographic of potential drone users.
It did, yeah. This amendment addressed a very practical and, frankly, significant barrier to entry, particularly for a crucial demographic, folks in rural and agricultural sectors.
Okay, how so?
It modified Form D4, which is the application form for a remote pilot certificate, by removing the mandatory requirement of possessing an Indian passport for identity proof.
That's huge. I can imagine how that must have impacted a lot of people, especially in rural areas where passports might not be common.
Exactly. That was the feedback they received. So what can applicants use instead now to prove their identity and address for an RPC?
So applicants can now furnish other commonly held government-issued proofs of identity and address, things like a voter ID card, a ration card, or even a driving license.
Much more accessible.
Much more accessible.
All right.
This was a direct and highly responsive change, particularly welcomed by individuals in rural and agricultural areas. Drones are becoming incredibly valuable for applications like crop spraying, land surveying, precision agriculture.
Yeah, huge potential there.
And the previous passport requirement was a significant impediment for many who simply didn't have one or found obtaining one a lengthy, difficult process. This change really demonstrates a commitment to making drone technology and its benefits accessible across the board.
This rapid succession of amendments, the original 2021 rules, then the 2022 and 2023 tweaks isn't just about, you know, minor corrections. It speaks to a larger principle about India's approach to this new technology, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. This rapid legislative agility highlights a responsive and iterative policymaking process. It shows that the government isn't just issuing rules and then letting them sit there unchanged for years.
Right. They're actively listening.
They seem to be actively refining the regulatory environment based on ground-level challenges, industry feedback, and emerging needs, rather than adhering to a static framework. This systematic removal of friction points truly underscores the strategic intent to accelerate drone adoption across all key economic sectors. It's a dynamic legal environment, not a fixed one, which is, you know, both a challenge and an opportunity for businesses to stay informed.
Definitely keeps everyone on their toes.
Okay, so we've covered the big picture legislative shifts. Now let's get down to brass tacks. Know your drone. Because understanding the specific legal requirements for your drone starts with its classification, which is based squarely on its weight. This is really step one for any new operator, right?
That's absolutely correct. The Drone Rules 2021 establish a very clear five-tiered system for classification, and this classification is the foundation, the absolute starting point, for all subsequent compliance obligations you will face. It's based purely on the drone's maximum all-up weight, or AUW.
And AUW includes payload, right? Not just the drone itself.
Correct. Total weight drone plus anything it's carrying.
So let's break down these categories precisely. What are they and what are their exact weight ranges? People need to know this.
All right, let's list them out, starting from the smallest. And remember, these are critical for determining your compliance path. First, we have nano drones. These are any drones with a maximum all-up weight of less than or equal to 250 grams. Think tiny. This category has the fewest compliance requirements.
Okay, 250 grams or less.
Next are micro drones. These weigh more than 250 grams, but are up to and including 2 kilograms. This is a very common category for many consumer-grade drones, like the ones you might buy off the shelf.
Right. 250 grams up to 2 kilograms.
Then we move to small drones. These are more than 2 kilograms and up to 25 kilograms. These often include more professional camera drones or those used for surveying jobs.
Okay, 2 kilograms to 25 kilograms.
Following that, we have medium drones weighing more than 25 kilograms and up to 150 kilograms. This category can include larger industrial or agricultural drones, maybe for crop spraying on a bigger scale.
25 kilograms to 150 kilograms.
Got it. And finally, the largest category, large drones, which are any drones weighing more than 150 kilograms. These are serious pieces of equipment. This classification, as I said, is crucial because it dictates everything from whether you need a UIN to pilot requirements and operational restrictions.
And once you enter your category, the next mandatory step for most drones is obtaining that unique identification number, or UIN. This is essentially your drone's digital license plate in India, much like a car registration.
Correct. Think of it exactly like that. Every drone operating in India, unless it falls under a specific exemption like the nano category for non-commercial use, must be registered on the Digital Sky platform to obtain this UIN.
And its purpose? Traceability.
Traceability and accountability. It functions as a unique digital identifier, ensuring authorities can track each aircraft operating in the Indian airspace. From a legal standpoint, it's about knowing who owns and operates which drone. And it's not just a digital number. The rules mandate that you must physically display this UIN on the body of your drone for easy visual identification.
Okay, so you need to stick it on there. How does one actually go about getting this UIN? Walk us through the step-by-step guide to Digital Sky registration for a drone owner. What's the process?
Sure. The entire registration process, importantly, is conducted online through the Digital Sky platform, making it accessible from anywhere. This digital process is key to that non-intrusive monitoring philosophy we talked about.
Correct.
So, step one, you visit the Digital Sky portal, that's digitalsky.dgca.gov.in, and create a profile. You can register as an operator, a pilot, or a manufacturer, depending on your role in the ecosystem.
Okay.
Step two, once you're logged in, you apply for the UIN. Now, if your drone requires a type certificate, which most commercial drones do you use Form D2 for the application? If you have an exempted model, like a nano drone used non-commercially or maybe a custom-built one for R&D, you'd start by adding it as an exempted model using Form D3 first.
Got it. So different forms depending on the drone.
Step three. You then need to provide comprehensive information about your drone. This includes details like its manufacturer, model, serial number, all its technical specifications. You also have to provide details about the owner, individual, or company like Aadhaar and PAN numbers, linking the drone directly to a legal entity.
Right, tying it to someone.
Step four, you'll be required to upload necessary documents. This typically includes a copy of the drone's type certificate, if it's applicable, proof of ownership, such as an invoice or bill of sale, and crucially, clear photographs of the drone itself from the top and front, along with a close-up image showing the serial number clearly visible.
Okay, photos are important.
Step five, there's a nominal, non-refundable fee of 100 rupees, which must be paid online to process the application.
Pretty reasonable.
And finally, step six, once your application is submitted and verified by the DGCA, they will issue the UIN digitally through the platform. It's designed to be a streamlined process to get your drone legally registered with minimal hassle, ensuring compliance right from the start.
So a UIN is for individual drones, like a vehicle registration plate.
Yeah.
But there's also something called a type certificate, or TC. What is that, and why is it important from a safety and compliance perspective? Is that for the drone model itself?
Exactly. A type certificate is a fundamental design and safety approval issued by the DGCA for a specific type or model of drone, not the individual unit. It's mandatory for virtually all drone models intended for operation in India.
Okay.
Think of it as a stamp of approval confirming that the drone model meets the government's required safety, security, and quality standards before it's even allowed to be sold or flown legally in the country.
Are there exceptions?
The exceptions are very specific. Nano drones, as we've mentioned, and model aircraft used purely for recreational purposes are exempt from needing a TC for the model.
And how does a manufacturer or maybe an importer go about getting one of these TCs? Does every single drone need one or just the model type?
No, just the model type. To obtain a TC, a manufacturer or an importer applies using Form D1 on the Digital Sky platform for a specific drone model they intend to market or use in India.
All right.
Critically, they must then submit a prototype of that drone model for rigorous testing by an accredited body. This is often the Quality Council of India, the QCI, or another testing entity authorized by the DGCA.
So it actually gets tested physically?
Yes, it undergoes thorough testing to ensure that the drone design meets all the prescribed safety and quality standards before that model is allowed into the Indian market. It's a crucial pre-market compliance step to ensure a baseline level of safety across different models.
Okay, so we've got categories based on weight, UINs for individual drones, and type certificates for drone models. To make this really crystal clear for our listeners, let's use what we're calling our drone compliance matrix. This is an at-a-glance summary of what's required for each drone category regarding UIN, TC, and the Remote Pilot Certificate, or RPC. This is kind of the aha moment for many operators figuring out exactly what applies to them.
This is indeed a crucial summary, yeah, because it distills the core requirements based purely on the drone's weight category. Let's break it down. Let's start with nano drones, those weighing 250 grams or less. For these, you're exempt from UIN registration. You're also exempt from needing a type certificate. And importantly, a remote pilot certificate is not required for non-commercial use.
Okay, so basically free rein for hobbyists with tiny drones.
Pretty much. This makes nano drones the easiest category to operate legally for hobbyists, reflecting their lower perceived risk profile.
Okay, so that's quite liberal for the smallest category. What about micro drones, weighing between 250 grams and 2 kilograms? This is where it gets a bit more nuanced, you said.
It does. For micro drones, UIN registration is mandatory, so you still need that digital license plate. A type certificate for the model is also required.
Okay.
Now, when it comes to the remote pilot certificate, the RPC, it's not required for non-commercial use, but, and this is the key distinction, it is required for commercial use.
Ah, the commercial versus non-commercial split.
Exactly. This highlights that for micro drones, the intent of use can fundamentally change your compliance requirements. A hobbyist flying a micro drone just for personal enjoyment has different legal obligations than someone using the exact same drone for, say, a paid photography gig or a real estate shoot.
Got it. That's a really important distinction. And then for the larger categories, small drones, which are 2 kilograms to 25 kilograms, medium drones, 25 kilograms to 150 kilograms, and large drones, over 150 kilograms. Do the requirements consolidate here? Are they all the same?
Yes. For all three of these larger categories, small, medium, and large, the requirements become consistent and generally more stringent. UIN registration is mandatory for all of them, no exceptions. A type certificate for the model is also required for all.
Okay.
And a remote pilot certificate is mandatory for operating any of these, regardless of whether the use is commercial or purely recreational.
Right. So if it's over 2 kilograms, you need the works.
Essentially, yes. If you're flying anything from a small professional camera drone all the way up to a large logistics drone, you need to ensure you're fully certified and compliant across all three points.
Yeah.
UIN, TC for the model, and an RPC for the pilot. This matrix really helps simplify understanding your core obligations based just on your drone size and your intended use for micros.
That's a super clear breakdown of the drone requirements themselves. Now let's shift focus to the pilot's mandate, obtaining that remote pilot certificate or RPC. Who exactly needs one of these and for what kind of drone operations? This is the actual license to fly for many, so it's crucial.
Right. The RPC is the official credential, your digital license to fly, for most drones operating in India. It's mandatory for anyone operating a drone in the small, medium, or large categories.
Regardless of use.
Regardless of whether you're using it for commercial purposes or purely recreational ones, if your drone falls into one of these larger weight categories over 2 kilograms, the pilot needs an RPC. Period.
And you mentioned earlier that it's also required for a specific type of micro drone operation.
Oh.
That seemed like a subtle but important point people might miss.
Yes, that's correct. And it's a detail that often trips people up, I think. While a micro drone used strictly for non-commercial purposes doesn't require the pilot to have an RPC, if you're operating a micro drone between 250 gram and 2 kilograms for commercial purposes, then obtaining a remote pilot certificate becomes mandatory for the operator. This emphasizes that even for these smaller drones, if there's any form of monetary gain, business-related activity, or compensation involved, you step into a different compliance bracket and need that pilot certification.
So if you do need an RPC, what are the eligibility criteria? What qualifications do you need to demonstrate to get certified to fly legally? What boxes do you have to tick?
The eligibility criteria are clearly laid out in the rules, and they're designed to ensure pilots have a baseline level of maturity, education, and physical fitness to operate safely. First, in terms of age, you must be between 18 and 65 years old.
18 to 65, okay.
For education, you need to have passed the 10th class examination or its equivalent from a recognized board. Basic schooling.
Right.
Crucially, you must have successfully completed the required ground and practical training from a DGCA-authorized remote pilot training organization, or RPTO. This isn't something you can just self-study for online. It requires formal instruction at an approved center.
Formal training is key.
Regarding identity proof, following that important 2023 amendment we discussed, you must possess a valid government-issued identity and address proof. This can now be an Indian passport, a voter ID card, a ration card, or a driving license. Much broader now.
Good, that opens it up.
And finally, you need to submit a medical fitness certificate from a registered medical practitioner. This is just to ensure you're physically and mentally fit to operate the drone safely without posing an undue risk.
Okay, standard stuff for operating machinery, basically. So these remote pilot training organizations, the RPTOs, sound like they are truly the cornerstone of pilot certification now. What exactly is their role, and what do the training typically entail? Is it like getting a regular pilot's license, but, you know, for drones?
RPTOs are essentially DGCA-authorized flight schools, yes, but specifically for drones. They are solely responsible for imparting the necessary training to aspiring drone pilots, and they have to follow a curriculum prescribed by the DGCA.
Right.
A typical RPC training course is quite intensive, usually structured as a 5-day program, but it's very specifically tailored for drone operations, not manned aircraft.
What do they cover?
The program comprehensively covers both theoretical knowledge and practical hands-on training. The theoretical component delves into critical areas like the drone regulations themselves. You need to know the rules, fundamental aerodynamics, understanding weather or meteorology, which is crucial for safe flight.
Yeah, wind and rain matter.
Exactly. And the practical training involves hands-on experience. This often starts with simulators to build basic control skills in a safe environment, and then progresses to flying actual live drones, but only in an approved green zone airspace under supervision.
So you get real stick time.
You get real stick time, yes.
And once you've completed all that training and passed whatever tests they give you, how is the RPC actually applied for and issued? Does the individual apply directly to the DGCA, or does the RPTO handle it?
The RPTO plays a crucial role here in streamlining it. Upon successful completion of the training and passing all the requisite tests, the RPTO is actually responsible for applying for the RPC on behalf of the student.
Oh, okay. They do the paperwork.
They handle the application submission via Form D4 on the Digital Sky platform. The remote pilot certificate is then issued digitally through the platform, which is much faster and more efficient than traditional paper licenses.
And how long is it valid for?
Once issued, it remains valid for a substantial period of 10 years, unless, of course, it gets suspended or canceled for some violation. So it's a long-term credential once you earn it, provided you continue to fly legally and responsibly.
Okay, so we've covered the general rules, the classifications, the certificates for drones and pilots. But like any good legal framework, the Drone Rules 2021 also provide specific exemptions. Let's talk about flying under the radar, legally speaking, and maybe touch on some of those gray areas that still exist in the law.
Right. It's important to understand these exemptions because they're designed quite strategically to encourage certain types of use, like recreational flying or research, without imposing unnecessary regulatory burdens in those specific contexts.
So what are the key exemptions?
Okay, let's run through the main ones. As we've mentioned a couple of times, nano drones, those tiny ones weighing 250 grams or less, enjoy the most significant exemptions. They are fully exempt from needing a UIN registration and a type certificate for the model. Also, an RPC is not required for their non-commercial operation.
So hobbyists flying tiny drones are largely free from the main compliance steps.
For non-commercial use, yes. This reflects their lower risk profile.
Okay, what else?
Then we have micro drones used for non-commercial purposes. Now remember, for an individual operating a micro drone between 250 grams and 2 kilograms, strictly for non-commercial purposes, they are exempt from needing to obtain a remote pilot certificate.
But the drone itself still needs things.
Yes, and this is critical. The drone itself must still be registered to get a UIN, and the model must have a type certificate. So it's not a complete free pass. The drone itself still needs to be compliant. Just the pilot doesn't need the RPC if it's purely non-commercial flying.
Okay, that's clear. And what about for those working on the cutting edge in research and development? Is there a specific legal exemption there to foster innovation, given the government's big push for India to be a drone hub?
Absolutely. And this is a key provision designed specifically to foster local innovation. The rules provide a very significant exemption for research and development R&D activities.
How does that work?
Recognized R&D entities, this includes academic institutions, government-recognized startups, etc., are exempt from needing a type certificate, a UIN, or an RPC for the drones they operate within their own or rented premises, provided these premises are located in a designated green zone airspace.
Ah, so they can test things out more easily.
Exactly. It's a deliberate move to foster innovation by removing major regulatory hurdles for experimental and developmental work. It allows them to test prototypes and new ideas without needing full commercial certification at every single stage of development.
Makes sense for R&D. And finally, what about those classic model aircraft that people fly purely for hobby or education, like model airplanes?
Mm-hmm.
Are they caught up in all these new drone rules?
The rules address them, too. For model remotely piloted aircraft that are used purely for recreational and educational purposes, they are specifically exempt from the requirement of a type certificate for the model.
Okay.
This acknowledges their traditional use and generally lower risk profile when used purely for hobbyist activities, distinguishing them from the more complex or potentially commercial applications of other drones.
Now, this brings us to a really crucial point, one that sounds like a bit of a legal gray area and could potentially trip up even well-meaning operators. The rules provide that exemption for non-commercial use of micro drones without an RPC, but you mentioned the legislation itself doesn't offer a clear, unambiguous definition of what actually constitutes commercial versus non-commercial activity. This seems like a recipe for potential compliance risk, doesn't it? What does this ambiguity mean on the ground for people?
It absolutely is a significant challenge for operators, and it's honestly a point of ongoing debate and uncertainty within the industry. The lack of a clear, legally defined line means that operators might inadvertently cross the threshold from what they perceive as purely non-commercial activity into something that could be legally interpreted as commercial activity.
And find themselves in violation without realizing it.
Exactly. They could find themselves in violation of the rules, potentially facing penalties. Let me give you a couple of illustrative examples of where this line gets really blurry and poses a legal risk.
Yeah, examples would help.
Okay, imagine a hobbyist who captures some absolutely stunning drone footage, maybe of landscapes or wildlife, and then uploads it to a YouTube channel that happens to be monetized through ads.
Right, common scenario.
Is that commercial use requiring an RPC because they might earn ad revenue? Or consider a real estate agent who uses their personal micro drone to capture impressive aerial images for a property listing they're handling. They might not directly build a client for the drone service itself, but it's clearly enhancing their commercial offering and helping them sell the property.
So in these scenarios, is the operator required to have an RPC or not? The rules are essentially silent on these specifics, creating a genuine legal uncertainty for many people. What should a listener take away from this specific gray area? How should they approach it?
Exactly. The rules don't give a definitive answer. The lack of a clear definition means operators really need to exercise extreme caution. My advice generally would be, if there's any financial consideration involved, any direct or indirect business benefit, or any form of compensation changing hands, even potentially down the line.
Err on the side of caution.
It's safer to assume it could fall under commercial use and go ahead and obtain the remote pilot certificate to ensure full compliance. This gray area really emphasizes the need for careful consideration and maybe even seeking legal advice if you're unsure about your specific use case. It's an evolving space, and what might seem like personal use today could be construed differently if the intent or outcome has any tangible commercial or financial implication.
That's really practical advice. It highlights the ongoing evolution of the law. Let's shift gears now to another fascinating and maybe slightly paradoxical aspect of India's drone policy, the import rules. Because while domestic operations have been liberalized to an unprecedented degree, the import landscape for finished drones is incredibly restrictive, and you said that's by deliberate design. What's the legal basis for this restriction? Why the clampdown on imports?
Indeed, it's a very deliberate and calculated strategy, and the primary goal is to bolster domestic manufacturing, the Make in India initiative for drones. A pivotal shift occurred on February 9th, 2022, with the issuance of a notification by the Directorate General of Foreign Trade, DGFT notification number 54201-5-2020.
Okay.
This notification fundamentally changed the import policy for drones that fall under a specific HS code, which is the customs code used globally.
What was the core change in status for drone imports? How did it change?
Previously, the import of drones under HS code 8806, that's the Harmonized System Code for Unmanned Aircraft, was categorized as restricted.
Meaning you could import, but with permission.
Right. It meant you needed prior clearance from the DGCA and an import license from the DGFT. There was even a specific exemption carved out for nano-category drones, which didn't need DGCA clearance or an import license back then.
Okay.
But the February 2022 notification changed the status from restricted to prohibited for drones imported in completely built up, CBU, semi-knockdown, SKD, or completely knocked down CKD forms.
So basically no importing ready-to-fly drones or kits.
Pretty much. It effectively created a blanket ban on the import of ready-to-fly or easily assembled foreign drones intended for general civil use. Whether it's a drone fully assembled or just a box of parts ready to be clicked together, importing those for regular use is now prohibited.
So it's a ban for general civil use. But are there any legal gateways, any specific exceptions to this prohibition? Surely the government wouldn't cut off all access to foreign technology completely, especially for strategic needs like defense or R&D.
You're right. The prohibition isn't absolute, but the exceptions are very narrow and very specific, and they come with extremely strict controls. Drones can still be imported, but only for two main purposes. First, for research and development, R&D, but only by specific approved entities.
Who qualifies for the R&D exception?
Government entities, educational institutions recognized by central or state governments, government-recognized R&D entities, and importantly, domestic drone manufacturers themselves who might need foreign tech for development.
Okay, and the second purpose?
The other major exception is for defense and security purposes, where the needs are clearly strategic and vital for national interests.
And for these exceptions, what's the approval process like? Is it straightforward, or is it as rigorous as it sounds? Getting something through a prohibited list usually isn't easy.
Oh, it's far from straightforward. For these specific exceptions, the importer must obtain a specific import authorization directly from the DGFT. This authorization is granted only after rigorous consultation with and clearance from the relevant line ministries, typically the Ministry of Defense or the Ministry of Home Affairs, who have to assess the genuine strategic need.
So multiple ministries involved.
Yes. This process is intentionally designed to be rigorous and time-consuming. And crucially, it is absolutely not intended as a backdoor route for general commercial or recreational drone imports. It's reserved for very specific, high-priority national interests, making it a tightly controlled legal avenue.
So if fully built drones are largely banned from import, how does India plan to become this global drone hub they're aiming for? It seems like a contradiction at first glance. What's the strategic linchpin here? How does this import ban actually help?
This is where the, well, you could say, clever strategic linchpin comes in. The component advantage. Yes. The 2022 notification that banned CBU SKD CKD drone imports explicitly states that the import ban does not apply to drone components.
So parts are okay.
Parts are okay. The policy for importing drone components is designated as free, meaning they can generally be imported without needing that special authorization from the DGFT. This provision is the absolute cornerstone of the government's strategy to create a robust domestic drone manufacturing and assembly ecosystem. Indian companies can source the best parts globally, motors, sensors, cameras, whatever they need, but they must assemble the final product in India.
Ah, I see. So it's a calculated two-pronged industrial policy then. Liberalize the use of drones domestically to create demand, but restrict foreign supply of finished products to protect the local market, while making parts easily available for local assembly.
Precisely. You've nailed it.
This isn't just simple protectionism, then. It's a high-stakes gamble to foster a self-reliant, make-in-India drone industry.
Exactly. It's a classic import substitution strategy, but executed with a modern twist for a high-tech sector. By making it significantly easier for sectors like agriculture, logistics, infrastructure inspection, and surveying to use drones legally, the government has intentionally fueled massive domestic demand.
Right.
The import ban then prevents established foreign manufacturers from directly fulfilling this growing demand with their off-the-shelf finished products. Simultaneously, the free import of components empowers Indian companies to build and assemble drones locally, specifically to serve this captive and rapidly growing domestic market.
So the success hinges on Indian companies stepping up.
Entirely. The success of this strategy hinges entirely on whether Indian companies can rapidly innovate, scale up production, and meet this demand with quality products, all while being shielded from the direct competitive pressure of established global giants in the finished goods market. It's a very shrewd, if challenging, approach to building an indigenous industry from the ground up.
That's a very clear explanation of the strategic intent behind what looks like a paradox.
Yeah.
But even if you manage to import a drone under one of those narrow exceptions, or more commonly you're importing components,
yeah,
there's still the cost of entry in terms of customs duty and clearance procedures, right?
Yeah.
What are the financial compliance implications there?
Yes, absolutely. The free import policy for components doesn't mean they are tax-free. Even for the rare cases where a fully built drone is legally permitted for import, say for approved R&D purposes, it's subject to customs duties.
How much, typically?
The approximate total customs duty lands somewhere around 31%. This typically breaks down into a 10% basic customs duty, BCD, then a 10% social welfare surcharge, SWS, which is calculated on the BCD amount, and finally an 18% integrated goods and services tax, IGST, levied on the total value plus duties. Some sources suggest the total can range slightly, maybe 28% to 35%, depending on how customs officials classify and value the specific import.
Okay, so a significant cost. And for the components, while they're free from a DGFT licensing perspective, they're not duty-free either, are they?
No, definitely not duty-free. While the import of components is free from needing that special DGFT authorization, they are still subject to applicable customs duties. These duties vary considerably based on the specific HS code of each individual component.
So it depends on the part.
Exactly. A motor might have a different duty rate than a camera sensor or a flight controller board. Manufacturers need to factor these varying component duties into their production costs and supply chain planning.
And what about the standard documents required for customs clearance when legally importing anything related to drones, be it a full drone under exception or components? Is there a specific checklist for that? What paperwork do you need?
Yes. For any legal import consignment, you'll need a standard set of documents for customs clearance. This typically includes a commercial invoice detailing the goods in value, a detailed packing list, the airway bill or bill of lading for transport.
Standard import docs.
Standard import docs. Plus, any necessary regulatory approvals specific to the import. For drones and many of their components, this often includes an equipment type approval, or ETA, from the Wireless Planning and Coordination, WPC, wing of the Department of Telecommunications.
Why the WPC?
That's required for any device that uses radio frequencies for communication or control, which most drones and their controllers do. And of course, if you are importing a prohibited item like a full drone under an R&D or defense exception, you absolutely need that specific DGFT import authorization document we talked about. So while the policy aims for strategic outcomes, the practicalities still require meticulous documentation and compliance with various government agencies.
All right, let's talk about the actual rules of the sky now.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter how great your drone is, how compliant it is, or how perfect your pilot certificate, safe and legal operation in India is entirely contingent on strict adherence to the national airspace map. This sounds like your absolute pre-flight essential.
That's absolutely right. This map is not just a suggestion or a guideline, it's a mandatory, dynamic, and interactive tool available on the Digital Sky platform. All operators are legally required to consult this map before every single flight they conduct.
Every single time.
Every single time. It's your pre-flight essential, indicating precisely where you can and cannot fly, and what permissions, if any, you might need for that specific location and altitude. Ignoring this map means you're effectively flying blind from a legal perspective, and potentially illegally, with significant potential repercussions.
So how is India's airspace segregated for drones?
Mm-hmm.
What are these zones we keep hearing about, and what do they mean for drone operators in terms of legal permissions?
The airspace is divided into a clear three-tier system designed to manage drone traffic effectively and safely. First, we have the green zone. This is largely unrestricted airspace. For drones with an all-up weight of up to 500 kilograms, no prior permission is required to fly within a green zone.
Okay, green means go, mostly.
Mostly. This is where most recreational flying and basic commercial operations tend to occur. The standard altitude limit in a green zone is 400 feet, which is about 120 meters above ground level, AGL. However, there's a specific nuance in your airports. Within the airspace located between 8 and 12 kilometers from the perimeter of an operational airport, even if it's technically designated as a green zone on the map, the maximum permitted altitude is restricted down to 200 feet or about 60 meters AGL. This provides an extra safety buffer near airports without imposing a complete ban further out.
Okay, so green is mostly free flight within specific altitude limits, lower near airports. What about the yellow zone? This sounds like it involves more control.
It does. The yellow zone is designated as controlled airspace. This means that any drone flight operations planned within a yellow zone require prior permission from the concerned air traffic control or ATC authority.
Who would that be?
It depends on the location. It could be the Airports Authority of India, AAI, the Indian Air Force, IAF, or the Indian Navy, depending on who controls that specific patch of sky.
Where are these yellow zones typically found?
This zone typically includes any airspace above 400 feet in a designated green zone. So if you want to fly higher, you need permission. It also includes the airspace within a lateral distance of 5 to 12 kilometers from an airport's perimeter. Importantly, the new rules significantly reduce the extent of the previous yellow zone around airports. It used to be a sprawling 45 kilometers. Now it's down to 12 kilometers, which reduces the area requiring specific ATC permission quite a bit.
That's a big change, 45 down to 12 kilometers. And then the ultimate restriction, the red zone. This is presumably where you absolutely, under almost no circumstances, can fly a drone legally.
Precisely. The red zone is straightforward. It's a no-drone zone. Flying any drone in a red zone is strictly prohibited by law.
Any exceptions at all?
The only exception is if explicit, specific permission is granted directly by the central government itself, which you can imagine is a rare and highly specific authorization reserved for extraordinary circumstances, likely involving national security or emergency response. For all practical purposes, for regular operators, red means stop, do not enter. These are typically high security or highly sensitive areas where any drone operation poses a significant potential threat.
And to ensure these zone rules are actually followed in practice, there's that critical safety and security feature called NPNT, or no permission, no takeoff. How did that work? Is it like a software lock on the drone?
NPNT is a cornerstone of compliance enforcement under the new rules, and it's mandated for all drones operating in India, with the sole exception of those tiny nano category drones. This system essentially ensures compliance by design, acting as a digital lock or gatekeeper. NPNT compliant drones are equipped with specialized software that fundamentally prevents their motors from arming, that is, powering up for flight, unless the drone has first received a valid, digitally signed flight permission directly from the Digital Sky platform.
And that permission is specific?
Yes, it's specific to that particular drone's UIN for that specific time window and that specific geographical location, geofence. It acts as a real-time, automated digital gatekeeper, ensuring that drones simply cannot take off in restricted red or yellow zones without authorization, or even in a green zone if they haven't logged their flight plan correctly in some cases. It's a powerful enforcement mechanism built directly into the drone's operating system.
Beyond these color-coded zones that you check on the map, there are also several types of areas that are more or less permanently designated as general no-fly zones across the entire country, right? Where are these located, and what's the legal justification for making them off-limits nationwide?
Yes, these are critical areas to be aware of, as they often override any other zone classification shown on the map, usually for overriding security, safety, or strategic reasons. First, area's new airports. As we mentioned, drones are generally prohibited within a 5-kilometer radius of major metropolitan airports. Think Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Kolkata, Bengaluru, Hyderabad. For all other airports, the default no-fly zone is within a 3-kilometer radius. This is purely for air traffic safety, preventing collisions with manned aircraft.
Okay, airports are key. What else?
International borders. You cannot legally fly a drone within 25 kilometers of India's international borders. This specifically includes sensitive areas like the line of control, LOC, with Pakistan, and the line of actual control, LAC, with China. This is obviously due to national security concerns.
25 kilometers is quite a buffer.
Strategic locations in Delhi. Given the capital's importance, there's a specific 5-kilometer radius no-fly zone around Vijay Chowk in New Delhi, which is close to Parliament House, Rashtrapati Bhavan, and other critical government buildings.
Right, the heart of government.
Government complexes nationwide. Within a 3-kilometer radius of state secretariat complexes in all state capitals, drone operations are generally prohibited, again, for security reasons, military and strategic installations. There's a default no-fly zone of 2 to 3 kilometers around military bases, cantonments, and other strategic locations, as specifically notified by the Ministry of Home Affairs. These lists can be updated, so operators need to be aware.
And environmental areas.
Yes, finally, eco-sensitive areas. You cannot fly over national parks and wildlife sanctuaries without obtaining specific prior permission from the Ministry of Environment, Forest, and Climate Change. This is to protect wildlife from disturbance and maintain the integrity of these sensitive ecological zones.
And what about specific metropolitan areas? I imagine cities like Mumbai and Delhi, with their high population density, critical infrastructure, and strategic importance, have even more granular and stringent restrictions on top of these general rules. Flying in big cities must be tough.
They absolutely do. And navigating these urban skies legally requires extreme diligence and often specific local permissions beyond just checking the digital sky map. In Delhi, as the capital, it's heavily restricted. Red zones include not just the 5-kilometer buffer around Indira Gandhi International Airport and the 5-kilometer radius around Vijay Chowk, but also numerous other sensitive government buildings, military cantonments, foreign embassies, and diplomatic enclaves. It's a highly controlled airspace environment where almost any flight, even in apparent green zones, might require additional local police or security clearance.
So extra careful in Delhi. What about Mumbai?
Mumbai is perhaps even more restrictive, practically speaking. The DGCA map might show some theoretical zones, but effectively, large parts, if not the entire city, are often treated as a red zone by local authorities due to constant security perceptions. Unauthorized drone flight is considered a serious punishable offense there. Furthermore, the Mumbai police frequently issue temporary blanket bans covering the entire city for all flying objects, including drones, often citing intelligence inputs about security threats. So even if the DGCA map shows a small green patch, local police orders often override it, making legal operation very difficult without explicit high-level permission.
Wow. Okay. So Mumbai is basically off limits without special permission. Kolkata.
In Kolkata, key no-fly zones include the standard 5-kilometer radius around Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose International Airport and, importantly, the airspace around the Eastern Command headquarters at Fort William. Recent reports of unauthorized drone sightings in the area have led to heightened police and military vigilance, indicating that these zones are actively monitored and enforced. Chennai also has extensive restrictions. Much of the city is considered a red zone, often requiring specific permission not just from DGCA via digital sky, but also from state or local police authorities for private operators to fly legally. The 5-kilometer radius around Chennai International Airport is, of course, a permanent no-fly zone.
And Bengaluru, the tech hub. Lots of sensitive places there, too.
Yes, Bengaluru features multiple overlapping no-fly zones due to the presence of Kempegowda International Airport with its 5-kilometer radius, the older HAL airport, which still handles some traffic, the Yelahanka Air Force Station, and numerous sensitive defense and research establishments like ISRO, Indian Space Research Organization, and DRDO, Defense Research and Development Organization Labs. Operators in these major cities face significant limitations and must exercise extreme caution, often needing to navigate multiple layers of permissions beyond the basic drone rules.
So we've covered the legislative framework, the administrative requirements on digital sky, and the literal rules of the sky with zones and no-fly areas. But what happens when things go wrong or when there are disputes about these rules or perhaps concerns about privacy or security? This is where the judiciary comes in, right? How does judicial interpretation shape this landscape of drone law and compliance in India?
Yes, the Indian judiciary plays an absolutely crucial role. It's not just about the rules written down, it's about how they're interpreted and enforced, and vitally, how they interact with fundamental rights guaranteed by the Constitution. While the Supreme Court hasn't, as far as I know, directly ruled on the constitutional validity of the drone rules, 2021 themselves, its landmark judgments on related issues, particularly privacy, along with various high court rulings on specific drone cases, provide a vital framework for understanding the evolving legal landscape and how the rules are applied in real-world scenarios.
And the most significant judicial precedent affecting drone operations must be the Supreme Court's major ruling on the fundamental right to privacy. This is a huge one for any surveillance technology, right?
Undoubtedly. The landmark Supreme Court case of Justice K.S. Puttaswamy, Rettab B. Union of India from 2017, is paramount here. This unanimous 9-judge bench ruling unequivocally established the right to privacy as a fundamental right, protected under Article 21 of the Constitution, the right to life and personal liberty.
And what was the test the court laid down?
The court held that any intrusion into this fundamental right by the state must satisfy a stringent 3-part test. First, it must be backed by a valid existing law. Second, it must serve a legitimate state aim. And third, crucially, the intrusion must be proportionate to the objective it seeks to achieve. It can't be excessive.
So why is this specific judgment on privacy so profoundly relevant to drones? Because on the surface, it's about privacy in general, not specifically drones.
It's profoundly relevant because drone technology, by its very nature flying cameras, sensors possesses immense potential for pervasive surveillance. It allows for monitoring from above, potentially into private spaces in ways previously impossible or much more difficult.
Right.
What's noteworthy here is that some observers have pointed out that the drone rules, 2021, are relatively silent on explicit privacy safeguards compared to the preceding, albeit short-lived, UAS rules of 2021, which did include some specific data protection provisions.
So there's potentially a gap.
There's an argument that there might be a gap. This regulatory situation means that any large-scale drone surveillance conducted by state agencies, or potentially even by private entities, if not carefully managed, could be legally challenged as a disproportionate infringement on the fundamental right to privacy, using the Puttaswamy judgment as the benchmark. It places a significant constitutional check on how drones can be used for monitoring and data collection, reminding everyone, government and private operators alike, that even if a flight is technically compliant with airspace rules, privacy concerns remain paramount and constitutionally protected.
Beyond the Supreme Court's foundational privacy ruling, various high courts across India have been actively adjudicating on specific drone-related matters. These cases seem to provide practical insights into how the rules are being applied and enforced on the ground, and they act as a crucial check on executive power and local enforcement actions, don't they?
They do indeed. These high court precedents provide invaluable context showing how the rules and related legal principles play out in specific real-world situations. They really shape the ground reality. Take the Bombay High Court, for example. In a notable case, the court actually quashed an FIR, that's the initial police complaint filed against some individuals who had been booked for flying a drone during the Prime Minister's visit to Mumbai.
Why did they quash it? Flying during a PM visit sounds serious.
The court's decision wasn't actually about whether flying the drone was appropriate or not. It was based squarely on the finding that the police had failed to properly promulgate the prohibitory order banning drone flights as required by procedural law. They didn't publicize the ban correctly.
Ah, procedure matter.
Exactly. This judgment underscores a critical legal principle. Procedural correctness by authorities is paramount. Actions taken by law enforcement, even in high security situations, can be successfully challenged in court if due process is not strictly followed. It's a check on arbitrary enforcement.
That's fascinating. A win for procedural justice.
Mm-hmm.
What about the Karnataka High Court? You mentioned a case there that touched on national security and data theft.
Yes. The Karnataka High Court took a strong stance in a case involving alleged data theft from a drone company that was supplying drones to the Indian military. The court actually ordered the formation of a special investigation team, or SIT, to properly probe the matter.
Why did the court intervene so directly?
It intervened after observing that the initial police investigation appeared lax or inadequate, going so far as to term it potentially a fake investigation in its observations. This ruling highlights the judiciary's recognition of the high-stakes nature of drone technology, particularly in the sensitive national security domain, and its willingness to step in decisively to ensure the integrity of investigations, especially when serious issues like potential cyber espionage targeting defense suppliers are suspected. It shows the courts are vigilant about protecting critical infrastructure and data associated with drone tech.
And the Madras High Court seems to have taken a more nuanced balancing approach in one instance, modifying a local ban.
That's right. In a case concerning a large religious conference, the Madras High Court demonstrated a balanced approach. The local police had imposed a complete blanket ban on drone usage over the area. The High Court modified this ban.
How so?
It permitted the limited use of two specific drones, but only for the purpose of event coverage within the venue premises and under strict conditions. This illustrates that courts may view absolute, overly broad prohibitions imposed by local authorities as potentially unreasonable restrictions, especially when they hinder legitimate activities like media coverage or event management. The judiciary can, and sometimes does, adopt a more balanced approach, allowing for conditional and controlled use of drones under specific circumstances rather than upholding blanket bans unquestioningly. It's a reminder that such bans can sometimes be challenged as disproportionate.
The Delhi High Court has also been involved in a couple of interesting drone-related cases, one of which actually involved the court directing the use of drones by authorities.
They have, yes. In one instance, the Delhi High Court actually directed municipal authorities in the city to use drones for surveillance specifically to identify illegal constructions and encroachments. This is quite significant because it's an example of the judiciary explicitly sanctioning and even mandating the use of drone technology for administrative efficiency and governance purposes, recognizing its utility in public administration and urban planning.
Interesting. And the other Delhi case.
In a separate, much more complex matter, the court was involved in handling a case concerning the security clearance denial for an aviation services firm. This firm was allegedly linked, perhaps indirectly, to the origin of drones that were reportedly used in a cross-border attack incident. This shows the judiciary's deep involvement in highly complex national security issues that are intertwined with aviation law and technology, demonstrating its reach into very sensitive geopolitical and security areas where drones are implicated.
And finally, the Calcutta High Court. Any notable involvement there?
The Calcutta High Court has also weighed in on drone usage, particularly concerning security. In one case involving a foreign national, the court directed the local police to intensify their vigilance regarding drone activities and submit a detailed report on drone use in the area. This particular directive was explicitly made citing national security concerns, again underscoring the judiciary's proactive role in addressing potential threats posed by unregulated or suspicious drone use and emphasizing the importance of legal and police oversight in this rapidly developing field, especially where foreign nationals or cross-border issues might be involved.
So when we look at these various high court judgments collectively, Bombay, Karnataka, Madras, Delhi, Calcutta, what's the overall judicial impact on the drone ecosystem in India? What does this pattern of intervention mean for someone trying to operate legally and stay out of trouble?
The collective impact is quite clear. The judiciary in India is not a passive observer merely waiting for rules to be broken in this rapidly evolving field. It is actively shaping the drone ecosystem. It does this by ensuring procedural fairness in enforcement, by taking national security interests very seriously, by balancing fundamental rights like privacy and freedom of movement with the need for public order, and even, as we saw in the Delhi case, by directing the proactive use of the technology for public good.
So compliance is more than just the rule book.
Exactly. For any drone operator, manufacturer, or other stakeholder, this means that legal compliance extends well beyond just knowing the text of the drone rules, 2021 and its amendments. It crucially encompasses understanding the evolving interpretations, standards, and procedural requirements being set by the courts through these judgments. It's a dynamic, living legal framework, meaning you really need to stay abreast not just of new regulations coming from the government, but also of key judicial decisions that clarify how those regulations are applied and what constitutional boundaries exist.
This has been a truly comprehensive deep dive into India's drone law. We've navigated quite a journey, haven't we? From that highly restrictive past we started with to this new future supposedly built on trust and self-certification, covering the nuts and bolts of the legislation, the amendments, the crucial compliance steps, and now the vital role of judicial oversight.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating arc to trace. And I think the core message throughout this discussion, hopefully, is that the new rules, despite some gray areas and ongoing evolution, are fundamentally designed to facilitate immense growth in the drone sector. But they're trying to do that while maintaining crucial oversight for safety and security. It really is a delicate balancing act.
Trying to foster innovation without compromising public safety or national security, all through this meticulously crafted and, as we've seen, constantly evolving legal framework.
That's the goal, yes.
So to wrap things up and give you, our listeners, a really actionable takeaway, let's quickly go through an essential compliance checklist. This is for any responsible drone operator in India, pulling directly from our discussion today. Think of this as the absolute must-knows to fly legally.
Okay, think of this as your immediate action plan, your go-to guide for legal compliance. It distills the key steps. Step one, identify your drone. First things first, as we emphasize, determine its weight category, nano, micro, small, medium, or large, because all your subsequent legal obligations flow directly from this initial classification. Know what you're flying.
Right, weight is key.
Step two, certify and register. For virtually all drones, except those exempt nanos and model aircraft, ensure your specific drone model has a valid type certificate, or TC, issued by the DGCA. Then you must register your individual drone on the Digital Sky platform to obtain its mandatory unique identification number, or UAN. This is your drone's digital license plate and proof of its legal existence in the system.
Get the paperwork for the drone itself.
Step three, get your pilot certificate. This is about you, the operator. If you are operating a micro drone for commercial purposes, or if you're flying any drone in the small, medium, or large categories over 2 kilograms, you absolutely must obtain a remote pilot certificate, or RPC. This involves completing the required training at a DGCA-authorized RPTO. Don't skip this. Flying these without an RPC is illegal.
Get yourself certified if needed.
Step four. Check the airspace map. This is non-negotiable and needs to be done before every single flight. Consult the latest interactive airspace map on the Digital Sky platform to know the precise green, yellow, and red zone classifications for your intended area of operation at that specific time. Do not skip this step. It's your primary safety and legal guide for where you can fly.
Know before you go. Every time.
Step five, ensure NPNT compliance. Your drone, unless it's a nano, must be equipped with that no permission, no takeoff functionality. And you must obtain the necessary digital flight permission via the Digital Sky platform before each flight, especially in controlled yellow airspace or if required by specific conditions. This ensures your drone physically cannot take off without authorization, reinforcing those legal boundaries.
Make sure the tech compliance is there.
Step six, respect privacy and follow operational rules. This is about how you fly. Always maintain a direct visual line of sight, VLOS, with your drone, unless you have specific BVLOS permissions, which are still rare. Adhere strictly to altitude limits, typically 400 feet AGL in green zones, lower near airports. Fly only during the daytime unless you have specific DGCA permissions for night operations. And crucially, remember the constitutional right to privacy we discussed, even if the drone rules themselves are light on specifics. Always avoid flying over private property without explicit consent and be extremely mindful not to capture images or videos of individuals in a way that infringes upon their reasonable expectation of privacy. Legal compliance isn't just about the drone and the airspace. It's also about respectful and ethical operation towards others.
That's a powerful and practical checklist. Covers the drone, the pilot, the flight, and the ethics. And looking ahead, it's crystal clear the Indian drone ecosystem is far from static. It really feels like a journey, not a final destination, regulation-wise.
Absolutely. It's still very much evolving. The government has already indicated plans for even more sophisticated developments down the road. Things like the creation of integrated unmanned traffic management, or UTM, systems to automate flight approvals and manage dense traffic.
Like air traffic control for drones.
Exactly. Also, establishing dedicated drone corridors, perhaps along highways or rivers, specifically for cargo deliveries. And eventually, formulating clearer regulations for advanced operations like controlling drone swarms or conducting regular beyond visual line of sight BVLOS flights, which will unlock entirely new applications in logistics, inspection, and mapping.
So the message for anyone listening who's involved or wants to get involved in this dynamic and rapidly growing sector, whether as a pilot, a business, an investor, is that staying informed about these continuous regulatory developments will be absolutely crucial.
Without a doubt.
The rules of the sky, it seems, are still being written, perhaps more in pencil than in permanent ink right now, inviting continued curiosity, adaptation, and exploration. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.